So just picture this for a second. Imagine you're the absolute ruler of a massive oil-rich nation.
Okay, I'm with you.
And for 25 years, you've had four different American presidents basically handing you a blank check.
Right, just total unconditional support.
Exactly. You are, for all intents and purposes, invincible. But then a peanut farmer from Georgia moves into the White House and he changes the geopolitical rules overnight.
Which is a massive shift.
Yeah. And suddenly your entire empire collapses in a matter of months. So our mission today for this deep dive is figuring out how a superpower accidentally destroys its own greatest asset just by, trying to course correct its moral compass.
It's a fascinating question, and you find the answer by really looking at the mechanics of an alliance that was built entirely on a single foundational intervention.
Right.
We're looking at this amazing dossier today, declassified U.S. records, scholarly retrospectives on the 1979 Iranian Revolution.
Yeah, there's some incredible stuff in there.
There really is.
Yeah.
And the overarching theme across all these sources is that this crisis was not, spontaneous combustion. It was basically the delayed detonation of a bomb that was planted a quarter century earlier.
Delayed detonation, I like that. Because to understand that delay, we really have to look at the bookends of this story, which, interestingly enough, feature two Democratic presidents 25 years apart.
Right, Truman and Carter.
Exactly. So back in 1951, Harry Truman is sitting in the Oval Office, and Iran has just nationalized its oil, which up until then had been under British control.
And the British were not happy about
No,
that.
they were furious. And this nationalization is led by Iran's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. So the British are begging Truman to help them topple Mossadegh.
And Truman just says no.
Flat out refuses. He views this as like a post-colonial resource dispute. He wants to mediate, and he absolutely refuses to authorize a coup.
But then, the political machinery in Washington changes really rapidly after that.
Right, Truman leaves.
Yeah, Dwight Eisenhower takes office, and he brings a completely different calculus to the situation.
Yeah.
The lens just snaps from this regional oil dispute to the global Cold War chessboard.
The stakes suddenly feel much higher to them.
Exactly. The Eisenhower administration looks at Mossadegh's nationalism, and they see a terrifying vulnerability to Soviet influence. So consequently, the CIA and British intelligence orchestrate a covert overthrow in August 1953.
And it was fast, right?
Unbelievably fast. It takes just 4 days to remove Mossadegh, totally dismantle the democratic apparatus, and restore the young monarch, the Shah of Iran, to absolute power.
4 days to just erase a democracy.
Yeah.
The CIA codenamed that intervention Operation Ajax. And it basically establishes the autocratic bargain that defines the region for decades.
Right.
The next 25 years, Washington provides the Shah with unconditional support. We're talking endless weapons, diplomatic cover, everything.
And in return, the Shah acts as America's, heavily armed policeman in the Persian Gulf.
Keeping the oil lanes open, keeping the Soviets at bay.
Exactly. But then we hit our second bookend.
The late 1970s.
Right. Jimmy Carter enters the White House, and he brings a radically different instinct to the presidency.
Yeah, let's unpack that. Imagine U.S. foreign policy is this giant Jenga tower.
Okay.
For 25 years, this major load-bearing block at the bottom has been unconditional support for the Shah. And President Carter just decides to pull that block out and replace it with a new metric human rights. Predictably, the whole tower starts to wobble.
It really does. The sources show that Carter's paradigm shift, it was a deliberate structural dismantling of the Nixon-era doctrine of realism.
Right, because Nixon's policy was very much, well, it operated on the premise that the internal domestic behavior of an ally didn't matter.
Exactly. As long as that nation served broader U.S. strategic interests, Washington didn't care what they did at home.
But Carter completely rejected that.
He did. He campaigned heavily on the idea that America's moral standing in the world had been hollowed out, by Vietnam, by Watergate, and by these really cozy relationships with dictators.
But what's wild in the dossier is seeing that this wasn't just like a candidate making lofty campaign speeches.
No, he actually acted on it.
He bureaucratized morality. He created a brand new State Department bureau specifically dedicated to human rights.
Wow.
And he appointed a dedicated assistant secretary with the actual power to enforce these standards.
Right. So we are talking about fundamentally altering the machinery of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah.
Suddenly, there's this internal mechanism actively scrutinizing the very allies Washington had spent decades unconditionally backing.
And the mechanics of that scrutiny were pretty severe, weren't they?
Very. Carter started tying U.S. arms sales and financial assistance directly to human rights benchmarks.
Okay, so think about how that felt on the ground for the Shah. He goes from having a total blank check from Washington to suddenly being scolded.
And you have to recognize how thoroughly this shattered his established reality in Tehran.
Yeah, because following Operation Ajax, he hadn't exactly been running a free society.
Not at all. The Shah had consolidated absolute power using his secret police, SAVAK.
Right, SAVAK.
Which is an organization the U.S. and Israel had actually helped establish in the late 1950s.
Wow.
And SAVAK was an instrument of pervasive fear. They used widespread censorship, arbitrary arrest, torture.
Just brutal stuff.
And for 20 years, through Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Washington, either looked the other way or actively commended the Shah for maintaining stability.
Which brings up a theory I kind of want to run by you, based on the readings.
Yeah, go for it.
The Shah's regime seems to have functioned like an organism relying on an exoskeleton.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it.
Because he had essentially zero domestic democratic legitimacy. Right. So his perceived unconditional backing from the United States, that was his armor.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when Carter's new Human Rights Bureau starts demanding that SAVAK stand down, Carter didn't just hurt the Shah's feelings, he removed the exoskeleton.
That is an incredibly precise way to view the power dynamics there. The Shah was paralyzed by this sudden shift.
Was he totally blindsided?
Completely. He had constructed his entire psychological and political identity around being Washington's indispensable man.
Right.
So when Carter demands liberalization, the Shah begins to panic. He starts making these half-hearted concessions.
Like what?
Releasing a few political prisoners here, loosening press censorship slightly there. He's trying to appease Washington without entirely relinquishing his own control.
But halfway measures in an autocracy usually just signal blood in the water.
Exactly. The Iranian street realizes the secret police's leash is suddenly being held tightly by Washington, and Washington is pulling back.
So the fear just evaporates.
Right. The perception of American invincibility had been the Shah's ultimate shield. The moment that shield appeared vulnerable, the domestic unrest in Iran, which had been simmering for years, just boiled over into massive public protests.
Because the public recognized the daylight between the Shah and his American patrons.
Yes, and they rushed right into that gap.
So what happens when the American administration realizes their new human rights policy is rapidly destabilizing their most heavily armed ally?
Well, it gets messy. The sources show that Carter's own team completely fractured over this.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. It's like a corporate board divided over a toxic asset.
That's a good analogy.
You've got Secretary of State Cyrus Vance arguing that keeping this polluting factory, the Shah's brutal regime, will eventually destroy the company's brand and viability forever.
Right.
But on the other side, National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski is screaming that if you shut the factory down today, the company goes bankrupt tomorrow.
Because that factory produces all your revenue.
Exactly. They are using entirely different metrics to define survival.
And Brzezinski's metric was the existential struggle of the Cold War. If you read his memos to Carter in the declassified files, they are just filled with urgent, stark warnings.
What was his main argument?
He viewed Iran not as a human rights dilemma, but as the geographic linchpin preventing Soviet expansion into the warm waters of the Persian Gulf.
Oh, so it was purely strategic for him.
Entirely. For Brzezinski, the Shah was hosting these critical American listening posts in northern Iran that tracked Soviet missile launches.
Wow, okay.
If the Shah fell, Brzezinski calculated an immediate catastrophic loss of intelligence and this massive strategic vacuum that Moscow would inevitably fill.
I mean, honestly, looking at Brzezinski's argument, I find myself wondering if he isn't entirely right.
It's a pilling point of view.
Doesn't it seem dangerously naive for Vance and the State Department to demand a dictator soften his grip when the alternative could be a hostile anti-American state right on the Soviet border?
Well, Vance's counterargument relied on structural reality rather than immediate geopolitics.
How so?
The State Department analyzed the Shah's regime and concluded that tying the United States to a brutally repressive dictator was just a terminal policy.
Like it had an expiration date anyway.
Exactly. Vance's position was that a pressure cooker without a release valve will inevitably explode. By completely ignoring the abuses of SAVAK, the U.S. was ensuring that when the explosion finally came, the collateral damage would take the entire American alliance down with it.
So Vance argued that applying human rights pressure to force the Shah to create those release valves was the only way to save the alliance long term.
Yes, But the ultimate tragedy for the Carter administration is that this internal civil war paralyzes them.
Washington gets stuck in an endless loop of debate.
Right, and they start sending the Shah completely mixed signals.
State Department officials are telling him to respect human rights, while the Defense Department quietly whispers for him to crack down and restore order.
And while Washington argues, the streets of Iran decide the country's fate.
Yeah, the protests evolve into massive nationwide strikes that basically shut down the oil industry.
The monarchy, this institution the CIA spent millions to install and protect, is revealed to be entirely hollow the moment the fear of SAVAK dissipates.
And we really have to look at the specific nature of that domestic opposition, right? Wow,
definitely. The revolution of 1978 and 1979 was incredibly broad-based initially. You had students, secular leftists, merchants.
But it quickly took on a distinctly religious character.
Right, under the leadership of the exiled cleric Ruhollah Khomeini. And the sources point out this was a direct mechanical consequence of the Shah's own policies over the preceding 25 years.
Because following the 53 coup, the Shah had systematically hunted down all secular, democratic, and leftist political organizations.
Exactly. He eliminated the National Front, which was Mossadegh's old coalition, and he absolutely crushed the Tudeh Communist Party.
Which meant that by the late 1970s, the only institution left in Iranian society with the infrastructure to organize a nationwide resistance was the network of mosques.
Right. The clerics had the communication lines, they had funding networks through religious taxes, and they had physical gathering spaces that the secret police just could not entirely shut down.
That's fascinating. The Shah's own efficiency in eliminating moderate opposition basically ensured that his ultimate challengers would be radical clerics.
It's a classic unintended consequence.
So in January 1979, the pressure reaches the breaking point. The Shah flees the country.
The huge moment.
But it seems to me, reading through the sources, that the revolutionaries pouring into the streets weren't just protesting the Shah's secret police.
What do you mean?
Well, it feels like they were prosecuting a 25-year-old cold case against the CIA. Like the ghost of Operation Ajax was marching right alongside them.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, the primary sources from the revolution, the pamphlets, the speeches, the chants in the streets, they are completely saturated with the memory of 1953.
So it wasn't forgotten at all.
Not even a little bit. For the Iranian public, the 1953 coup was the original sin of their modern political history.
Wow.
Prior to that intervention, the United States was actually viewed quite favorably in Iran. They were seen as an anti-colonial idealist, you know, in stark contrast to the British and the Russians.
But Operation Ajax shattered that perception instantly.
Overnight, it proved to the Iranian public that their sovereignty, their attempt to govern themselves, was entirely expendable to Western strategic needs.
So overthrowing the Shah in 1979 wasn't just about removing an autocrat.
No, in the eyes of the revolutionaries, the Shah was never a legitimate monarch anyway. He was an American imposition.
Right.
The revolution was an attempt to retroactively correct the historical crime of 1953, to finally expel the foreign influence that derailed their democracy a generation prior.
And that historical trauma creates this profound psychological paranoia, which unfortunately directly ignites the next phase of the crisis.
The hostage crisis.
Yeah. Fast forward to the fall of 1979. The Shah is in exile, jumping from country to country, and he is dying of advanced lymphatic cancer.
Right.
Jimmy Carter faces a brutal decision. The Shah needs specialized medical treatment that's only available in New York.
But Carter is warned by his diplomats stationed in Tehran that bringing the Shah onto American soil is going to provoke a massive backlash.
Yeah, but he ultimately authorizes the medical visa anyway on humanitarian grounds.
And we really have to analyze how that humanitarian gesture was processed through the incredibly toxic lens of 1953.
Right, put yourself in the shoes of an Iranian revolutionary at that moment.
When the Iranian public heard the Shah was in America, they didn't see a dying man seeking chemotherapy. They saw the sequel to Operation Ajax being filmed right in front of their eyes.
And if you know your history, the paranoia is completely logical.
Totally.
In 1953, the Shah fled the country to Rome in the middle of the crisis. A few days later, the CIA successfully removed Mossadegh, and the Shah triumphantly returned.
Right. So seeing him welcomed into Washington in 1979 triggered this absolute certainty that the Americans were plotting to reinstall him upon the peacock throne all over again.
That terror of a counter-revolution was the spark.
It was. On November 4, 1979, militant students overwhelmed the security at the American embassy in Tehran.
Kicking off an absolute nightmare.
They seized the compound and took dozens of American diplomats and citizens hostage.
And what's crazy is that the revolutionaries used the embassy not just as a bargaining chip to demand the Shah be extradited, but as a literal crime scene.
Yes. They wanted to prove their historical grievances. They spent months meticulously piecing together shredded CIA and State Department documents found in the embassy to expose the depths of American espionage.
And this kicks off the agonizing 444-day hostage crisis. It becomes this nightly television spectacle in the U.S.
The daily humiliation.
Which eventually destroys Jimmy Carter's presidency. Especially after that disastrously failed military rescue attempt, Operation Eagle Claw.
And those 444 days fundamentally rewrite the geopolitical map. It cements an enmity between Washington and the newly formed Islamic Republic that still drives global headlines today.
But the fallout wasn't limited to the Middle East, right? The loss of Iran sparked a bitter, enduring debate within American political circles.
Oh, absolutely. A huge debate about the actual cost of Carter's moral pivot. The political autopsy of the Carter administration birthed a very specific conservative critique.
And we should unpack this because it remains highly influential in foreign policy circles today.
It does. This perspective was really crystallized by Jean Kirkpatrick, a political scientist who later served as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
Right.
She authored a famous essay essentially prosecuting the Carter administration for losing Iran.
Arguing that prioritizing human rights against a friendly autocrat was fundamentally self-defeating.
Exactly.
Let's lay out the mechanics of the Kirkpatrick doctrine because, again, our goal here is to unpack the source material neutrally, not to endorse either side of this political debate.
Sure, just looking at what she wrote.
She makes a very specific distinction between types of dictatorships, doesn't she?
Yes, she draws a hard line between traditional authoritarian regimes and radical totalitarian regimes.
Okay, what's the difference in her eyes?
Kirkpatrick argued that traditional autocrats, like the Shah, are undoubtedly repressive and corrupt, but they generally leave the underlying structures of society, family, religion, private property intact, because they don't seek to dismantle society entirely. Authoritarian regimes possess the capacity for gradual democratic reform over time, especially under friendly pressure from allies.
But a totalitarian regime is different.
Right. Totalitarian regimes, which she argued Khomeini's Islamic Republic represented, seek to completely control and remake every aspect of human life.
So her thesis is that by actively weakening the Shah over human rights abuses, Carter didn't pave the way for a flourishing democracy.
No, in her view, he just knocked down the only barrier preventing a far more dangerous, infinitely more repressive totalitarian state from taking power.
Wow. So she's saying accepting the flaws of a traditional dictator is just the tragic but necessary cost of keeping the world safe from radicalism.
That is the core of the critique.
Mm.
The traditional autocrat is the lesser of two evils, and intentionally undermining your own ally out of a misplaced sense of moral purity is a dereliction of geopolitical duty.
I want to introduce the counterview, though.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Because even just the phrase losing Iran implies that a sovereign nation of millions of people was an American asset to be managed or lost in the first place, right?
Right. That phrasing is definitely loaded.
So if Carter's human rights pressure accelerated the Shah's fall, does the counterargument place the blame for the chaos on Washington? Or does it exonerate Carter?
The counterview presented in the historical analysis exonerates Carter, mainly by focusing on the concept of inevitability.
Explain that.
The counterargument insists the Shah's regime was a terminal patient long before Carter ever took the oath of office.
Because of the repression.
Exactly. The absolute repression the Shah relied on after 1953 created an unsustainable pressure cooker. By actively eliminating all moderate secular avenues for political expression, the Shah guaranteed that his eventual downfall would be violent, chaotic, and driven by radical elements.
So the argument being that Carter didn't light the fire, he simply walked into a building that had been structurally burning for two decades.
Precisely. It's the exact opposite of Kirkpatrick's view. The counterargument suggests that if the United States had utilized its immense leverage to enforce human rights and democratic reforms in Iran 10 or 20 years earlier,
oh, I see,
rather than waiting until the system was collapsing in the late 1970s, a violent revolution might have been entirely avoided.
In this view, Carter's ideals were totally principled, and the disaster of 1979 was just the bill finally coming due for the short-sighted realism of the previous quarter century.
Right. It's a fundamental disagreement on how you maintain stability.
And we'll leave it to you, the listener, to act as the jury and weigh the merits of those arguments. Because this debate, whether enforcing human rights upon a flawed ally is a principled necessity or a self-defeating geopolitical blunder, It is a live wire.
It absolutely still dictates how modern superpowers navigate their relationships with complicated allies today.
It really does. When you zoom out and look at the whole 25-year arc we've discussed today, the tragedy is just palpable. You start with Truman's initial restraint in 1951, actively refusing to meddle in another nation's sovereignty.
Then you transition to Eisenhower's covert action in 1953, prioritizing Cold War containment, executing Operation Ajax.
And building that massive Jenga tower of an autocratic alliance.
Right. And finally, you arrive at Carter's attempt in the late 70s to inject human rights back into the equation.
But the structural damage is already done.
Yes, his ideals collide directly with the revolutionary blowback of 1953.
The exoskeleton of American support is removed.
The Shah flees, the 444-day hostage crisis begins, and the entire tower collapses into rubble.
Which brings us right back to our starting point. We often want a clean, spontaneous diagnosis for historical crises. But those don't exist here.
No, they don't.
1953 set a powerful template for backing friendly autocrats over fragile democracies, a template that has echoes far beyond the borders of Iran.
For sure.
And it leaves you with a deeply unsettling question to chew on as you look at modern geopolitics.
Look to that.
Is it even structurally possible for a superpower to peacefully course correct its moral compass once a transactional autocratic alliance is heavily entrenched? Or are modern nations forever trapped by the ghosts of their past interventions, destined to face a catastrophic reckoning the exact moment they try to do the right thing?